Hello, and welcome to this special edition of House of Commons. Today, as a guest, I have Patrick O'Flynn, who is the UKIP MEP for the East of England. Hi, Patrick.
Hi.
Patrick was political editor of the Daily Express and chief political commentator. He left the Daily Express to join UKIP, and he was their campaign director at the 2014 EU Parliament elections and the 2015 general election, and then was a key player in the referendum. So I'm going to speak to Patrick basically about his time during UKIP, what he thinks about the current way Brexit is going, but also I'm generally interested in what he thinks, how politics interacts with working class culture in the UK. So does that all sound okay, Patrick?
Sounds like a good agenda for conversation to me, yes.
Well, I hope so. I mean, obviously, being the host, I can talk about what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
So hopefully the listeners will agree with us, but I think they will. So let's start at the beginning. I mean, you were an incredibly successful journalist, but then you decided to jack it all in and go into politics, but not just go into sort of the traditional mainstream politics. You decided to join UKIP. Why did you do that?
Well, I suppose if you look back through my career, I've always had a sort of empathy with the underdog, hence, you know, working on the Daily Express rather than perhaps the Daily Mail. I've always been prepared to try, you know, the horrible phrase, think outside the box, but I was the political journalist who persuaded the editor and deputy editor of the Daily Express in 2010, just after the election, that the time had come when to be a Eurosceptic wasn't just to whine about the single currency or other integrationist things coming down the line, but to actually say, we need to leave this thing. And it became an amazingly successful campaign with hundreds of thousands of reader responses. But I saw in David Cameron, someone who had explicitly ruled out having a referendum, but after the result of the 2010 election, someone who was open to being pressurised because he found himself in a coalition with the Liberal Democrats, which simultaneously really alienated a big segment of the core Tory vote. And the fact that the Liberal Democrats had joined him alienated a big section of the core Lib Dem vote. And the result was that the core Lib Dem vote went onto the Labour pile. David Cameron found himself many points behind in the polls, not just on the issue of the EU, but there were other issues such as his general attitude to immigration at the time. Putting gay marriage through with no mandate, no mention in any manifesto, was a big cultural issue for Conservatives, and the potential for UKIP to be used, if you like, as a cosh round the head of the Conservative Party to force change. Seemed obvious to me, looking back to the days of James Goldsmith and the referendum party and how he actually made John Major effectively promise there would be a referendum before any decision to join the single currency. And I thought, give UKIP a fair wind here under this charismatic leader they've got, and let's see if we can do the same job on David Cameron that James Goldsmith did on John Major.
So how did your peers react to that? Because, I mean, I remember it at the time, and it was it was a pretty big move, because even though there's been a strong Eurosceptic voice within Fleet Street, this was actually a big step, forward or to the side compared to sort of traditional Euroscepticism.
Well, I suppose we did it in two moves. The first move was taking the Daily Express to be actually the paper saying, let's leave the European Union, you know, and that was thought to be quite far out. That was the autumn of 2010. And then the second step, even more far out, I suppose, to a conventional lobby correspondent, was joining UKIP, which, you know, at the time, certainly there was a stigma attached to UKIP. People would say they're the BNP in blazers and things like that. But as I say, I've become absolutely convinced and passionate about Britain leaving the European Union. And I could see, you know, in the communication skills and the charisma of Nigel Farage in particular, and the alienation of not just Conservative voters, but working class voters, I think, from the system, that Nigel was quite a reformer and had clamped down quite hard on the kind of wilder elements of UKIP, and you know, I was prepared to take a bit of stigma in order to achieve what I thought was this great patriotic cause.
But it's what I find really interesting is why Why was there stigma? Why do you think there was stigma? Because obviously, UKIP, from the time the Daily Express put their weight behind them, and from the time you left and helped out, and I'm not giving you all the credit for this, by the way, because obviously it was many people, but from 2010 to 2015, I mean, it was a massive meteoric political rise. So well, obviously they tapped into something.
Yeah, there are three reasons, really, I can identify for the stigma attached to UKIP. Point number one is that the left-wing media ideologically opposed UKIP and pushing the idea of UKIP being racist or fascist or even Nazi is one way of trying to tell people, you know, UKIP's not a respectable choice. The conservative-inclined media didn't want UKIP to do well because they saw it as a threat to the Conservative Party, you know, a rational interpretation there. So they too would push the idea, you know, Michael Howard's words were, I'm trying to think, gadflies, cranks and gadflies, and then Cameron upped that to fruitcakes, loonies and closet racists. So there's a sort of media pincer movement going on where the Conservatives wanted to retain their monopoly as the so-called Eurosceptic Party, and the left didn't want anything that could be perceived to be to the right of the Tories to have a place on the political space at all. But then there's the third reason, let's be frank about it, is that there were some elements in UKIP and some members of UKIP who had, you know, reactionary views. Some people in UKIP, very, very few, had openly racially prejudiced views. So there was obviously an element of reality. The media can't completely invent a fiction, I don't think. And what UKIP did by banning members of the BNP and the EDL from party membership and, you know, trying its best to vet people who were candidates was under Nigel, you know, probably someone who would be seen as a sort of Thatcherite libertarian, quite right wing on a lot of economic taxation issues, is nonetheless he was not remotely into racial politics, sort of blood and soil type nationalism, none of that. And, you know, to his credit, those are his politics are not racial politics. They are kind of economic, libertarian, patriotic view of the United Kingdom. So
I suppose the one pushback I'd have on that is, or a pushback I know people would say to me is, the line when you talk about immigration to race. So when, for example, very famously Farage stood in front of that poster of the line of refugees going into,
during the referendum
campaign, you know, was the line more blurred than you're sort of stating it?
Well, you see, I mean, Nigel and others in UKIP, no doubt myself as well, have spoken about uncontrolled immigration in pretty stark terms. I mean, I would argue that we were simply reflecting views across communities in the United Kingdom that were suppressed deliberately, and the unjustified accusations of racism thrown. You know, people say immigration is about space, not race. And certainly the predominant feeling in working class communities was about pressure on public services, the housing stock, downward pressure on wages for working class jobs. Nonetheless, there's also, I think, becoming more appreciated lately, there is a cultural aspect here of, are the people coming into our country, being invited or allowed into our country, do they have not only the right aptitudes to add to our economy and society, but the right attitudes as well? Do they subscribe to core British values, for instance, around gender equality, equality before the law? So I think there is a cultural aspect to uncontrolled immigration too. But I think overall the impact of UKIP majoring on this, several impacts. One, it forced the establishment party to talk about this issue. But let's be honest, secondly, it completely obliterated the British National Party and that kind of racist view of who was allowed to be British or not. And, you know, I know Nigel's quite proud of that. I'd be quite proud of it too.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to come back later towards sort of the journey of where UKIP are at the moment. But before we get there, I want to talk about really how UKIP became successful, because obviously the two real big breakthrough moments were the 2014 European Parliament elections, where UKIP came top of the poll.
Mm.
I mean, amazing for one of the non-traditional parties to come top of a national election poll.
Yeah.
And then the 2015 general election, where even though you only won one seat, in terms of the amount of votes you picked up across the board, showed massive support for a start-up political party, basically.
Yes.
So what do you put that success down to? I mean, if it's easier for you, do you want to start talking about 2014 and go into 2015?
I think we have to start slightly earlier, okay. Because don't forget that the crucial breakthrough, as far as I was concerned, as what's now termed a Brexiteer, someone who wanted the UK to leave the EU, was achieved at the end of January 2013, where UKIP didn't have any MPs, but had risen into double figures in the polls and had performed very strongly at a series of parliamentary by-elections. And that pressure, I think it's in David Laws' memoirs, he has Nick Clegg asking Cameron, why on earth have you pledged this referendum? And Cameron gives a two-part answer. One, many of my backbenchers are incredibly Eurosceptic. And two, I've got UKIP breathing down my neck. So I think I would put the rise a bit earlier than that. But obviously then, to actually go on and win the European elections was quite a stunning moment. And the whole UKIP was the story of 2014, there's no doubt about it. And that result, I think, made it pretty impossible for David Cameron, certainly, given his somewhat surprising majority in 2015, to walk away from the pledge. But I think we connected at a time when the Tories were under a very kind of liberal globalist outlook leader. And Labour again had a very sort of middle class, London based leadership, very politically correct. Our great success was with older blue collar voters, whether they had identified as long time Tories or long time Labour. And Nigel's particular unique selling point was, I think, the guy who tells it how it is. A lot of people would have thought that. And he was able to reach across the social spectrum to an extent, but within a certain niche of the public. But if you think in those European elections, I think we got just under 28% of the vote. Let's be fair, in a low turnout election on our home subject at a time post the Lisbon Treaty where all the other parties were seen to have ratted on a pledge of a referendum, the political context was quite juicy for us, really.
It was juicy for you, but I think these things don't happen by accident or by chance. I mean, I think and maybe if we go into the 2015 general election, I think what's really interesting is this was UKIP. I'm going to use my hands for inverted commas for this, which doesn't obviously work on a podcast very well. But UKIP was seen as a conservative problem. But the 2015 election really showed that actually across working class communities mainly, UKIP were rising in support, because I remember one of the things that coming through, it was in all this really safe Labour seats, UKIP were making a good fist of coming in a strong second.
Yes.
And so 2015 for me showed it wasn't just a conservative problem, it was actually something bigger than that.
I agree, and I think it showed the potential of UKIP. I got into a bit of trouble. I think it would have been maybe shortly after the European elections, where I went on, I think it was Sunday Politics, Andrew Neil, and I expressed the view that maybe UKIP had squeezed the flannel as dry as it could with Tory voters, and it was increasingly going to be working class Labour voters who would come. And don't forget that Cameron had by then pledged an in-out referendum, and Ed Miliband refused to, despite some people in his inner circle, I think Lord Wood probably, Stuart Wood was one of them, saying, look, there's no justification in denying, after so long and so much constitutional change, the people to have a vote on this. Ed Miliband wouldn't do it. And so there was a sort of bleeding across then of Eurosceptic habitual Labour voters to us. But people like me and Suzanne Evans, I think, helped that by completely closing down some sort of obvious own goal issues, like some of people who'd been in the party longer than us wanted to get rid of the NHS, going on about privatisation of the NHS, wanted things like a flat tax, which would in effect be sold by our political enemies as a massive tax cut for the rich, no tax cut for people on average wages. So,
see, I remember this is so funny, isn't it? It wasn't that long ago, but I remember when UKIP first sort of begun. I was going to say tooling up, but building up. There was actually a strong libertarian element to them.
There
were people who were traditionally maybe were in the Conservative Party, but actually didn't really think the Conservative Party were for them, and they joined UKIP. And there was part of it, which I think was it the 2010 manifesto, which was just a complete and utter hodgepodge mess of traditional sort of social conservative politics, along with real sort of mad libertarian policies put together. So at the beginning, there were these two wings which didn't fit together. But apart from the fact they didn't have a home.
Yes, I think I mean the libertarianism to me is a political creed that has minimal potential support, particularly if you think older working class voters. Older working class voters know they have paid their national insurance stamps for decade after decade after decade, and are now in a position where they might start needing the NHS. They expect the NHS to be there for them and support it 100%, and they're right to expect that. They're never going to vote for a party that says, let's rip up the NHS and trust private insurers to provide healthcare. As we know, private insurers can't even be trusted to compensate people who are insured and whose homes are flooded for a year, 2 years later. The idea that that could run a healthcare system, is not well founded. So, know, the NHS, I think Nigel is enough of a canny politician to see the bigger picture. And to retreat on his views, for instance, on healthcare, and to allow me, I became economic spokesman, to take the party somewhat to the left economically, although I kind of maybe overpulled on the elastic when I think the thing that really annoyed the libertarians most was I came up with this idea for making VAT outside the EU. We'd have, and that was one of the things that made the policy a virtue, in my view. But when we left the EU, we would create a progressive VAT where luxury goods attracted a higher rate than staples. That's when the old and new libertarians in the party really turned on me, and they called me Pinko Patrick.
It's funny, isn't it? It's all about the perspective of where you come from. But,
indeed, it's all relative.
I certainly, especially in the modern climate, you're certainly not a pinko. But but I mean, obviously, polling shows that public services are more appreciated by working class people than other classes.
Absolutely,
I mean, it's for obvious reasons, because working class people tend to rely on them more heavily, and the tax that they pay is more significant. So,
absolutely.
So they believe that they've put something in.
Exactly,
which they have a right to get back from.
Yeah, so. And I mean, I should say I'm very proud of the result in 2015 because there was a close general election between the two big parties, and yet nearly 4 million people stuck with us, knowing that we could tilt it one way or the other, and we had sort of buy in to our policies, not just on the EU and immigration, but whether it be foreign aid, defence spending, the military covenant, a whole range of different issues. We connected, but obviously we got smashed on the rocks a first past the post like the SDP before us. And I think part of the great slump of UKIP is to do with people who still share a lot of the agenda, thinking, well, they showed even when they were at their peak that under this electoral system, a UKIP vote is a wasted vote nearly everywhere. And that remains a big structural barrier for any insurgent party.
It does, but let's move on to the referendum, because obviously, in some sense, I think some people might have thought, or might think, that essentially the Brexit referendum meant that UKIP had done their job. But before I want to talk to you about where you think we're at with Brexit at the moment, I know you have some strong views on that. During the referendum campaign, am I right in thinking you were part of Vote Leave, but Farage and others went with Leave? Is it Leave
well,
EU?
Leave, initially it was Leave.eu, which then became sort of grassroots out, yes.
And so there was that separation. Now, can you describe that? Why did that separation happen?
Well, I think it would be fair to say that some people in Vote Leave were quite snobby towards Nigel, and unfairly so, given the amount of amazing spade work he'd done to get the referendum in the first place. And Nigel was keen to be, you know, a big player in the referendum campaign.
Well, he'd earned the right to be, I would say.
To an extent, yeah. But and that's true. And then from my point of view, though, not being a tribal lifelong UKIPper, but very goal orientated, the question I had to ask myself is which of these groups is more likely to get the sort of reach that's required to win what I always thought was going to be a high turnout referendum. I always thought it was going to be 16 or 17 million votes to win. And it seemed totally obvious to me that you would need, you know, big cabinet beasts with middle class reach, you know, and at the same time, perhaps Aaron Banks and Nigel could run a sort of secondary campaign more focused on blunter talking working class issues. Now, this obviously made me incredibly unpopular in UKIP, and I still, you know, suffer for it to this day. But it was the right decision from the point of view of a Brexiteer. And the two campaigns oddly complemented each other really well, apart from the horrible fact that they hated each other's guts.
Yes.
But at least that meant no one could say there was collusion between them. I think Chuckaramuna tried to say before the final Wembley debate that Vote Leave was running a Farage campaign, but everyone knew so much about the bad blood that that just didn't stick. So the campaign actually worked rather well, but we all still suffer from the really vitriolic hatreds that existed.
You know, after the referendum, I spoke to some senior people in Vote Leave, and they completely, I mean, they echoed exactly what you said, and they agreed, actually, in terms of an overall campaign, it probably was useful having those different focuses. Mm. Not that they ever would have wanted to work with Leave.eu, because they, you know, I mean, obviously, people probably remember, I mean, Aaron Banks was serving writs, I think, on Dominic Cummings and stuff like that. there was definitely, unless it was one of the greatest pieces of acting this century, there was, you know, I think it would be very hard for anybody to claim that the two different groups worked together and got on very well. But obviously, you know, it's funny how life works out. But okay, so so you're still an MEP for UKIP.
Yes.
So you're still part of the party.
Yes. Okay. Well, I was elected
as
UKIP to do a particular job, which is to get the UK out of the EU. And that job has not been done yet.
So what does Brexit mean then? Brexit means Brexit, but what, for you, what does Brexit mean? And I suppose to sort of make the question a bit more current, do you think the Chequers deal is what Brexit means?
No, I think the reasonable person test, it completely fails that. You know, we're signed up to this common rule book. It looks to me like we'll be indefinitely into this backstop with regard to not being able to solve an Irish border issue that I would argue Theresa May has done a lot to create herself in the unqualified undertakings since she's given. The biggest scandal of all is that she's run, a ship above the surface which says Brexit means Brexit, full Brexit. You know, even to some of her cabinet ministers, this was the direction that they thought. And then a submarine underneath, which is basically viewing Brexit as a cynical sort of rebadging of existing arrangements. I think this is a massive betrayal. I think the Conservative Party is in desperate political trouble if it implements this form of fake Brexit. I think it could do to the Conservative brand what the Iraq war did to the Blairite brand.
So, I mean, that's a really big claim. I mean, what makes you think, what's the basis of that claim?
Well, just the degree of anger that I know among many Conservative friends of mine, the devastating accounts given by people like Steve Baker and Stuart Jackson of how the Department for Exiting the EU was misled while a wholly different negotiation was going on, spearheaded by Ollie Robbins and 10 Downing Street. People can smell this as a massive betrayal, and that Theresa May has been involved in, you know, one doesn't want to call a politician specifically a liar, but the political exercise has been a big lie. Yeah. The big lie is what's gone on. People who voted for Brexit wanted to be properly out of the EU, all its institutions, control of laws, borders, money, right to sign our own trade deal. You know, we're compromised to the point of negation on most of these issues.
So the argument against that, or that argument, was that people didn't vote to get poorer,
Well, this is why I must jump in straight away. Let me jump in straight away.
Yes, go.
People didn't vote to get poorer. Yeah, they say that, don't they? The Remainers.
That's the argument against it.
Listen, the Remainers spent the entire referendum campaign saying if you vote to leave the EU, you'll be voting to be poorer, right? That was their entire argument.
Project Fear, I think.
Yeah, and on the day, 17.4 million people voted to leave the EU. So under their logic, I don't see how that applies. No one votes to be poorer. What people voted for, I think, was to be a proper country again, to have that feeling of social solidarity. And for many millions of working people in particular, there's the advantage of let's control the influx of labour for working class jobs. And whatever the professional economists say, the any trade union negotiator worth his salt will know that control of labour supply is massively important to determining the price of labour. But more than that, that there are non-pecuniary factors in living standards. Knowing your neighbour, having a settled community, you know, having a level of cultural cohesion, you know, as well as all the pressure on public services and whether you can access them. These are all incredibly important things. Now, it may be that for the 12% of the economy that's about trading into the rest of the EU, it's inconvenient, absolutely. For some of the big corporations, you know, who have got cheap, unlimited labour, can sort of dodge around their corporation tax liabilities by paying in any EU jurisdiction. You know, it's all fine for them. You know, the distributional impact of our EU membership, you know, I looked at something today which said about 9 of the 10 poorest parts of Northern EU were in England. You know, it's not worked for the UK as a whole. So working people, I think, were making a completely rational judgment. And it may be that the economy, depending on what the final deal, is a little bit smaller for a little while. But I think the Treasury, etc., is measuring GDP rather than GDP per capita, because there'll be fewer people in, fewer mouths to feed. So nobody voted to be poorer. Well, they put their economic claims in that referendum repeatedly, and people voted to take back their sovereignty. And I think a lot of people thought, if it's bumpy for a while, so be it. We're getting something precious. I mean, in the financial crisis, which shrunk the economy directly by 6%, and because of retarding future growth, probably 10% overall, you know, we all got a lot poorer. We got nothing back for that whatsoever, you know, apart from bailing out the bankers and not sending any of them to prison. So, you know, if people are projecting 0.2% less growth for a couple of years, and we're getting back our sovereignty and our control, you know, I think that's viewed, particularly by working class voters, as a massive plus.
So I'm going to summarise where I think you're coming from and work it into a question. So if I get the summary wrong, do let me know. But essentially, as UKIP were growing, the main political classes, Labour and the Conservative, noticed them, worried about them, but actually ignored them and didn't respect the voters.
Mm.
You know, and that's why UKIP kept on growing. That's my sort of view, really, why they kept on growing. Then the referendum happened. The result was a vote to leave. And, I actually agree with you. Project Fear was very clear. And people did have, you know, people were told what people believed the choices were. I mean, obviously, everyone got one of those government leaflets, which I didn't read mine. I don't know if anybody read any of theirs.
Because I read it and I kept it.
Well, I'm sure you read
it. Pledge in the back about the government will implement what you decide. I always thought that would be useful.
But, you know, the sort of the dry economic case was set out by the government. But what you seem to be saying is actually the people who voted for Brexit and then had voted UKIP previously are now being betrayed.
And completely.
It's a strong word, but actually Brexit is not being delivered. So
yes.
And so that anger or that dissatisfaction which actually died down after the referendum sort of died down and UKIP's polling numbers sort of fell through the floor.
Absolutely.
And is coming back and we're seeing UKIP's polling numbers rise.
Yes.
But what's going to happen next? Because in the meantime, UKIP have gone down a route which is essentially the opposite route to the one you described earlier. I mean, the leader of current leader of UKIP gave a speech at the recent Free Tommy Robinson rally, which is, you know, Tommy Robinson, for those who don't know,
is basically the leader of the English Defence League. And
I think former leader, I think.
Well, I mean, it maybe he's the former leader.
But I'm not using that as a basic point, just as a factual
okay,
point.
Okay, former leader of the English Defence yes. League. But for somebody who, you know, it looks like that sort of far-right sort of movement, and UKIP are aligning. So, you know,
it certainly looks like a street aggro movement, doesn't it? And, you know, Gerard has spoken at a couple of rallies at which there have been sporadic outbreaks of violence. And, you know, the Tommy Robinson contempt sentence is currently under appeal, and I should note that. But nonetheless, it seems a very odd cause to me that can be boiled down to the proposition that Gerard and the Tommy Robinson supporters believe that one individual should be exempted from the laws on court reporting and contempt that every other individual has to obey. And as a former journalist who did a couple of stints of court reporting, I find that baffling. I mean, obviously, there's a wider emotional thing going on there.
But the signalling is a problem with it.
Yeah, massively.
I agree with you completely on the issue. I think it's, you know, if you campaign to respect law, it's an odd thing to sort of then campaign on. But ultimately, the signalling of it is that I mean, there are a couple of people, high-profile new right people who have joined UKIP recently. The guy who runs the website InfoWars, which is basically a paranoid, conspiracy theory type of website.
Were you talking about Paul Joseph Watson?
Yeah, Paul Joseph Watson.
Well, I have to say on him, I'm told that going back a few years, he was claiming some very outlandish things. But I have to say, as a political communicator and video maker now, he's pretty on the button in terms of pitching to the segments of the electorate what appear to be reasonable arguments.
Can UKIP go back to being the party that Nigel Farage is leaving, or is it now essentially going to become an English version of the National Front, the French National Front?
Well, I mean, I certainly hope, and I think it's the duty of UKIP to be the party that it was always meant to be, which was a party set up with the express purpose to get the United Kingdom out of the European Union. You know, Gerard is the leader of UKIP, and he believes in this stuff, and I would describe him as an anti-Islam fundamentalist, right?
I think he'd describe himself as
that. He probably would, wouldn't he? And unfortunately, with the way the leadership contest was done, he was elected unopposed, and incredibly onerous hurdles were placed by the National Executive Committee in respect of who wanted to stand in that election. So it was no surprise that he was the only one. But he hasn't had either the opportunity to sell that vision to the membership, or the membership to have had the opportunity to vote on that issue. Most of the UKIPers I know think that UKIP should be sticking to its core message and its core purpose to deliver Brexit. And what we need to do now to do that is become the broadest possible place for disgruntled Leave voters to come and to put their cross in the box for, not just in real elections, but in opinion polls, which, as you know, are incredibly closely looked at by Tory high command. I mean, UKIP's already taken 4 or 5 points off the Tory score and had an asymmetric effect. If we could take another 4 or 5 points, suddenly the Conservatives under this Brexit approach find themselves not 2 points ahead of Jeremy Corbyn as they were a few weeks ago, but 10 points behind. And that, to me, replicates the impact UKIP had in that 2010-13 period when we forced Cameron to do a 180. I think we can force the Conservative Party to do a 180 as it contemplates massive defeat.
I mean, to be honest, I agree. I think there is that potential, but how do you do that? I mean, because I think I can also see another direction for UKIP.
Well, look, that's happening already because the poll rating's gone up.
UKIP themselves as being that broad,
yes,
shall we say, the political wing of Vote Leave rather than, you know, I think that's what you seem to be describing in a sense.
Yes.
But currently with the current leadership and what he chooses to spend his time on, there is, you know, it is going down a broader route, which I think would put off a lot of people that you're talking about
joining
that broadcast.
And
so how do you change that? I mean,
well, Gerard seems determined to have this link with Tommy Robinson, and you know, I wish that he wouldn't. There will be a leadership contest in UKIP. Not that there's always one coming along soon, but at the end of March, because he's said he's going to stand down after a year and trigger a full contest at which he may or may not participate. I guess that is the moment where the big ideological battle takes place about UKIP kind of post-Brexit. But we're in this awkward position now where I think this political emphasis that he's come out with, you know, not only do I disagree with it, but I think it politically puts a lid on our capacity to rise in the polls and lever that amount of pressure that we need to. So I'm very glad, for instance, that Nigel Farage is taking a higher public profile and talking about coming back, perhaps standing in that leadership contest for UKIP. And I think because now the mission again is to connect with dyed-in-the-wool true blue Conservatives, Daily Telegraph readers, Daily Mail readers, you know, that mission of 2015 where we were reaching into Labour voters, it's not the thing at the moment. We need an asymmetric effect. We need to really pulverise the Tory poll rating while Labour kind of sails on at 40% in order to achieve in the very short term what we need to achieve. And Nigel, you know, is seen as, you know, you look at him, the clothes he wears, the things he says, pint of beer in the pub, whatever. He is a classic Thatcherite Tory to most people. And he has that potential to connect with the Daily Telegraph vote and to be the catalyst for this massive political service that UKIP can do.
So you think he should become leader again?
I would love it if Nigel was leader at the moment. He's not leader at the moment. I have to say Gerard has done a good job on some issues, and he's actually been spot on about Brexit, oddly enough, and I wish he'd stick to talking about that and about the self-confidence approach to Brexit that would have yielded a better result. But I, you know, I've had my ups and downs with Nigel, but at the moment, in the current political context, I think the more Farage, the better.
Okay. Well, that feels like a good point to end, maybe. Mm. This is the more Farage, the better.
No, I think Nigel, if he listens to this, might be slightly surprised. But I just think that's the context we're in at the moment.
I mean, before I sign off, and it's been a very interesting chat, and thanks for chatting to me. I mean, is there anything else you particularly want to say, or do you think we've sort of covered?
Well, I think we covered, and the future of UKIP is not ours to see. You know, my commitment is very much based on Brexit, so I'll have to sit down and think about my future. I stopped being an MEP, I hope, at the end of March 2019. You know, that's assuming Brexit does go ahead, which, you know, I still think on balance is likely. Then I have to think about the other things I believe in, how much of my future politics is still Brexit driven because so much of it is left undone. But you know, I think you only know how that feels when it actually happens.
That's true. That is true. Anyway, all right. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Pleasure.
So before I sign off, I would just like to, I can't remember if I introduced myself at the beginning or not, but I'm Nick Dennis. I'm part of Tory Workers, and I do this podcast because essentially I'm interested in politics and working class culture in the UK, and I speak to many interesting people. And thank you so much, Patrick, for talking to me about your experience in this. But before I sign off, I'd like to say that this is a Political Human production, and I'd like to thank Kevin MacLeod, who does the music for us. Thanks a lot. Bye.